This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The heat and drought that hit much of the nation this summer has devastated New England dairy farms. The price of grain to feed their cows has skyrocketed to the point where many small farmers lose money on every gallon of milk they sell. Reacting to their plight this week, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and other New England members of Congress called on the U.S. Department of Agriculture to review its milk pricing system, a complex set of rules and price controls stemming from the 1930s. Many have called this setup antiquated and a major part of what plagues farmers. And among these critics is our guest today, writer Kirk Kardashian. In his new book, Milk Money, Kardashian looks at the mysterious world of milk regulations and the toll they're taking on New England dairy farmers. He also examines other forces affecting them, from a global recession that reduced dairy demand to questions about milk as a healthful beverage to concerns that some dairy operations hurt the environment. Today in The Exchange, we look at these dire times for New England dairy, but also new models that may offer some hope. Let's hear from you, too. Do you work in the dairy industry? Why do you think this sector has struggled so much? What's the answer to those struggles? Also, if you consume dairy products, do you think these farmers deserve more help from the government or not? And would you pay more for milk if it meant supporting local farms? Or in these times, are you looking for the lowest prices possible? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Kirk Kardashian joins us from Dartmouth College. And Kirk, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, we keep hearing over the past couple of years just how bad things are for small dairy farmers here in New England. What did you see when you went out and talked to dairy farmers in your area, Kirk? How bad is it really?
Well, it's bad. I mean, if you can imagine going to work every day and not making money but losing it, you know, you have to pay your bills. You have to put food on the table. You have to pay your mortgage. And, you know, when you're losing money every day, that's hard to do. And it makes your life stressful, and you don't know what you're going to do in the future.
No, and that must be why we're seeing so many dairy farms bought up, sold to housing developers, or whatever. How do they stay in business, though, then? I mean, losing money every day on every single gallon they sell.
Well, there's a variety of ways. Some farms diversify their income with you know, by selling maple syrup or by plowing. Others just take money out of their equity. Some of these farms have been in families for generations. So, you know, they have a lot of equity in their property, and they can take out loans to pay their bills.
So this has been a long struggle, as you write in the book. I mean, the number of dairy farms has declined steadily decade over decade. But you also write, Kirk, that things really took a bad toll in the late 2000s. What happened? What were sort of the economic forces that converged at that point to spell real trouble for small dairy?
Yeah, well, 2009 was really the last dairy crisis, and prices plummeted, costs skyrocketed at the same time, and you know, that combination really just hits dairy farmers really hard. I mean, because they have to buy grain for their cows, they have to pay their bills, but when the price that they're receiving for their milk is so low, they're stuck. They have no other option. So what happened in 2009 and before that was there was a drought in other parts of the world that increased demand. Before that, so like in the years leading up to 2009, there was increased global demand. So farmers in this country increased their capacity to make milk. But then demand, with the global recession, demand just dropped pretty quickly. So all these farms that had built up their capacity now had lots of cows to feed, but much less milk to sell. So,
and at the same time, demand plummeted, as you said, with global recession. Costs went up. What kind of costs are we talking about here, Kurt?
Oh, talking about grain costs and also diesel fuel costs.
Those are the ones that went up. So it's kind of a perfect squeeze, isn't it? You're not making much money off of the milk you're selling, and at the same time, your costs to produce that milk are going way up.
Exactly.
So the regulatory system that milk operates, and boy, this is complicated. How did this federal regulatory system work with farmers in this in that dire time, or work against them? What do you think?
Well, I think the system, in large part, worked against them at that time because milk is the milk price is basically set by the federal government through the USDA. It's called the Federal Milk Marketing Order. And that system has been in place since 1933 in response to the Depression. And it was basically designed to keep supply and demand in check. And so the price of milk in different areas of the country was set based on how much milk was being made and how much milk was being demanded. But it didn't take into account the cost of production, which is the main problem. So you end up with a situation where the price is not reflecting how much it actually costs to make the product.
You know, can you tell us a little bit more about that, Kirk, because that's always been very confusing for me, why the federal government got involved in milk pricing to begin with. You said it was started in the 30s to keep supply and demand in check, but why? I mean, the government doesn't, you know, worry about the price of carrots or, you know, potatoes, so why milk?
Well, I think people agreed that milk was this sort of necessary commodity that everybody wanted and needed and was a nutritious food that could help keep people fed, especially during the hard times when people had trouble, you know, buying groceries. Milk, you know, is a nutritious, calorie-rich beverage. And I think, you know, the cooperatives at the time, they had some political muscle and they lobbied the agriculture secretary at the time. It was Henry Wallace to do something about it.
And
he did.
And did it work well in the beginning? Did it work in favor of dairy farmers, or was it kind of messed up from the start?
No, I think it did work well in the beginning. It sort of created some parity between the milk price and the cost of production. And you know, as the country sort of exited the Depression, we went into World War II. Demand went way up, and the government, you know, said to farmers, you know, look, we will buy all the milk you can possibly make. So things got better.
And then it started to get worse, though, right? I mean, later in recent years, we've heard just huge complaints about this system of price controls.
Yeah, it got worse it's a long story about how it got worse, but technology came in, and there were different federal programs that were also designed to basically guarantee farmers a price for their milk, like the price support system. Which is a whole other federal system that helps keep farmers in business. But over time, basically, what happened is that the cost of producing milk got out of whack with the price that they were being paid.
Wow! And last question on this whole regulatory system, and then a lot more to talk about based on your book, Kirk. But how do the farmers that you talk to feel about this system? Do they want to just produce on a free market, or do they want some government involvement?
Well, it varies. For every farmer you talk to, you get a different opinion on that. But I think they do appreciate, you know, having the government involved. But I think a lot of times they wish that there was, a stronger connection to reality from the pricing system. Because, I mean, you can imagine, you know, being in the position where the government is dictating how much you can be paid for your product when you know it costs you more to do that.
Wow. I'm kind of surprised that they still want the involvement, given that lack of reality that we're seeing today in the pricing system. You know, milk's still relatively cheap and the input's so expensive.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, farmers still appreciate the sort of safety net aspect of the government, that the government plays. There, you know, there are a couple of subsidies in play, the price support, the MILC program. The dairy export incentive programs. There's a couple things that the government has done to help farmers, and I think, you know, farmers aren't so quick to just to just leave that behind and say we want to go out on our own.
All right, Greg, let me invite our listeners to join us. And then a lot more questions about your book and some of the themes that you uncover in it. The book is called Milk Money, Cash Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. The author, again, is Kurt Kardashian. He's also a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. You can join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. If you work in the dairy industry, let's hear from you. Why do you think this industry has struggled so much in recent years? What do you think the answer might be to those struggles? Also, if your household consumes a lot of dairy products, would you be willing to pay more to help local farmers? Or in tight economic times for some Granite Staters, are you just seeking the lowest price possible? Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. You know, Kirk, you write that there have been other forces working against milk as well, in addition to these wild price swings for the inputs and this antiquated regulatory system. Been some question recently about whether milk is really a healthy beverage, competition from other drinks and so forth. Talk a little bit about that, if you could, that, you know, milk doesn't have the sort of dominant position that it once did in our society.
Yeah, well, it's true that the consumption of fluid milk has actually gone down since the 70s. It's been decreasing. And obviously there is a lot of competition from other drinks like, soy milk and almond milk and things like that. But I think the conventional wisdom says that, you know, that drinking milk in moderation, like you should drink and eat everything, is healthful. And it has lots of beneficial vitamins and minerals and enzymes. And not to mention, you know, vitamin D, calcium, omega-3s. It's a good product, and if you can tolerate it, if your body, can tolerate milk, then there's no reason why you shouldn't drink it.
If you can tolerate it, a lot more folks these days saying, maybe I am lactose intolerant.
Yeah.
Well, we will talk more about that after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls to the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And when we come back, more on the new book, Milk Money, Cash Cows and the Death of the American Dairy Farm.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More on the muddle over milk on the exchange coming up. And at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, President Obama, the UN, and different perspectives on the U.S. role in the world. 170 million Americans use public media every month to stay in touch with their world and their community. You're one of them. You can follow the debate over federal support for public broadcasting. Add your voice by signing up at 170millionamericans.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Community Medical School Lecture. It's personal, medicine's evolution away from one size fits all. Beginning October 2nd in Manchester, online at Dartmouth Community Medical School. And Granite State Candy Shop in Concord in Manchester, offering a wide variety of roasted nuts, confections, and chocolate bars for fundraising programs. NHChocolates.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New England's Dairy Dilemma. We're talking with the author of a new book called Milk Money, Cash, Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. The book looks at the many challenges of our region's small dairy farmers, and it also examines some new developments that may offer some hope for them. We invite you to join us. If you work in the dairy industry, let's hear from you. Or again, if the folks in your household consume lots of dairy products, we'd love your thoughts, questions, comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest is Kurt Kardashian. He's the author of the new book, also a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And Kurt, before we go to our listeners, just before the break, we were talking about competitive forces working against milk. Again, you mentioned people drinking soy milk and rice milk and more soda and more Gatorade and so forth. There's also been some questions among parents about hormones in milk causing problems like early puberty in girls, for example. Can you talk about that a little bit and whether it comes up in your book? People are worried about their milk sometimes.
Well, the hormone issue really came up back in the early 90s when dairy farmers started putting recombinant bovine growth hormone to their cows to increase their milk production, and it did have the effect of increasing the amount of milk that the cows made, but people also became worried that the hormones were being transmitted to them through the milk. So predominantly, I think almost all dairy farms these days don't use the RBGH. So I don't think it's an issue anymore.
RGBH, again, the bovine growth hormone that caused the controversy. And I remember there was a lot of questions about whether milk that had been produced with that hormone should be labeled or not. But you're saying at this point public pressure has been so great that almost nobody uses this?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I mean, the hard evidence that the hormone was being transmitted into the milk was virtually nil. So, while people had valid concerns, I don't think that the science was backing them up.
All right. Let's take some calls. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Patrick in Canterbury. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I was just wondering, do you think that farmers may be able to, or dairy farmers may be able to make a lot more or save a lot more by switching to a mostly grass-based diet as opposed to a wholly grain-based diet for the cows?
It's a good question, Patrick. Thanks for the call. What do you think? You know, we talk a lot, Kirk, about the cost of feed from the Midwest and how that's really hurt New England farmers because it's gotten more expensive. What do you think about Patrick's point?
Well, I think it's harder to run a farm based on just a pasture-based system. It's more work to graze the cattle, to graze your cows in a good pasture to rotate the pastures, and also the milk production is usually not as high when cows are just eating grass. So while it tends to produce a higher quality glass of milk, the milk tastes better and has more omega-3s and better enzymes and things, it usually costs the dairy farmer more to do that, or they basically can't produce as much milk as they otherwise would be able to if they used grain. So that costs them more too because they have capacity that's being not used.
Given the popularity of local food here in northern New England, wouldn't there be a market for this sort of pure, better-for-you, grass-fed, yeah, it's more expensive, but it's a great product kind of milk?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I really believe that it is a better product. Not only does it taste better, but it's also more sustainable, and it's better for the cows. And I think all the way around it's good. It's just economically, I think it's hard. It's hard for a lot of farmers to make that work. Some farms don't have as much grassland as they need, so they need to buy the grain and hay from other places. If you are lucky enough to have enough land to graze your cows, then it works, but it doesn't work for all farmers.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Tim's calling from Alstead. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm a president of a foundation that deals with local food issues. Most of my professional career has been consulting with dairy farmers over the last 20 years. And while the government price support and base price paid for milk produced is an archaic system, there's another aspect to why dairy farmers are essentially in the hole that they're in, is that agribusiness co-opted extension. Extension promoted dairy practices, which essentially said expand, buy your commodities to feed these animals because it's much more cost effective. So what we have here in New Hampshire specifically and all over the nation as a whole is the fact that we have too many dairy cows on too less acres, and the dairy farmers are forced to buy products from out of state. And if you cannot control your price, you have very little ability to make a profit.
So who are you blaming there, Tim, then?
Well, essentially what it was government agriculture programs got co-opted by large ag to essentially control the price of a raw product, which we call milk, and essentially forced an expansion, which eventually forced a reduction in dairy farmers, which was easier to control the price, and essentially the system snowballed. So as dairy farmers in New Hampshire and the East Coast and even in the Midwest now are facing critical situations of where they're going to get their feed because there's very little of it, they're realizing that this overextension of cows per acre has not allowed them to be self-sufficient. So essentially what we're going to have to see is a reduction in cow numbers on farms to basically balance the system back out to where each farm produces their own their total capacity for feed, and in certain years buy but not be dependent on buying external inputs every year, which is what we have in the United States.
Yeah, and you talk about this reduction in the number of cows in your book, Kirk. Go ahead to Tim's point, please.
No, well, I think you're right, Tim. That's what I've seen in reporting the book and in my research. You know that that Big Ag has co-opted a lot of the research that is coming out of the land grant colleges, and it's all been, you know, in one direction: how to make more milk with fewer cows and with less inputs. So it's put a lot more milk out into the system, even though we might not need it.
You know, it's easy to see small farmers as victims of Big Ag, of a regulatory system, the government, whatever. But I wonder if these smaller dairy operations that you covered, Kirk, in the book also made some mistakes on their own that are now catching up with them. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to judge, you know, the small farmers. I mean, they all have their own economic reality to deal with. And, you know, the only thing you can maybe say is that, you know, when prices go down, you know, farmers tend to try to make more milk to make up for the revenue loss.
Sure.
And, you know, in the aggregate, you know, it's like the tragedy of the commons. When everybody acts in their own self-interest in these situations, it can end up hurting the whole. And that's what happens a lot of times. When the prices go down, farmers make more milk, put more milk into the system, and that drives the price down again. So that's one thing that happens all the time. You know, other times, you know, I think farmers are just naturally optimistic people who will go and when times get tough, you know, they'll take out a loan and they'll say, you know, things will get better. I'll borrow some money for now, and when the milk price goes up, I'll be able to pay it back. And over time, you know, they might do that once or twice and get deeper and deeper into a hole. Things don't get better, and then they're stuck.
Yeah, and they love the lifestyle and being on the land. So it's hard just to say, oh, it's not working. I'm out of here.
Well, it's extremely hard, especially when you know, you're one of, say, four or five generations of a family who is that has been milking. I mean, that's a part of your DNA.
Right.
That's who you are. You know, you identify yourself as a dairy farmer. You have this whole dairy farm with lots of your cows that you love. You know, you have the land that you love, and giving that up is almost impossible.
Well, Tim, thanks for that call. And again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions or comments about the struggles of New England's small dairy farmers, as described in the brand new book called Milk Money, Cash Cows and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. The author is Kirk Kardashian. We're taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Kirk, a couple emails have come in. Here's one from Seth, who says, I question the accuracy of your guest's statement in terms of it being harder to graze in terms of time and being more costly. Where do you get your figures from? Seth says, yes, milk production goes down, but input costs go down too. That was in response to our first caller who asked about, wouldn't it be easier and cheaper to grass feed these cows, let them graze? Thanks, Seth, for the email. What do you think, Kirk?
Well, I think that that Seth is right that the, you know, if you have the land to grow to graze your cows on pasture, then it does work for you. But a lot of farmers don't have enough land to do that, so it's not really a feasible option for them.
You mean in New England, especially?
Well, not only in New England, I mean, throughout the country, you know, there's difficulty for farmers to find, you know, good grassland to pasture their cows on.
Seth, thanks for that email. Here's another email from Tim. He says, I don't feel the government should be in the dairy pricing business. Currently, milk is purchased based on the prices regulated by the government. Farmers could probably get a much better price on the free market. Milk bottling and cheese companies are the ones truly making the most money based on our government's inability to keep milk prices current to cost for the farmers. Tim also says, I do feel that there should be some programs in place to help farmers so our small and mid-sized farms don't disappear. I would pay more for milk if I felt it would benefit the farmer and not a large corporation. With two teenagers at home, we do consume large amounts of milk. Tim, thanks for the point. To his first point, if you could, Kirk, why aren't farmers just going out on the free market? Our emailer, Tim, says, look, the government shouldn't be in the dairy pricing business.
Well, I mean, going out on the free market is easier said than done. As a dairy farmer, you know, you're making milk, but you're not processing it and then selling it. Those final two steps are crucial for selling your milk. So, you know, there's a whole system that has developed over time to get the milk to market, and farmers, you know, they'll collect their milk from their cows, and they put it in the bulk tank, and then their co-op comes and picks it up, and they take it to a plant where it all gets mixed together and it gets processed, and then they'll ship it out to supermarkets. So, you know, for farmers to suddenly take on those last two huge steps in the supply chain is really difficult, and some farms have done it, and I think they are surviving and they're doing pretty well, but it's definitely the exception.
So trucking and processing, you know, your average small dairy farmer can't do that. It's too much.
Yeah, I mean, just to process the milk, you know, a facility, you know, to build a processing facility is going to cost multiple millions of dollars.
What's the role of these co-ops then? For example, Agrimark, I think, is the one a lot of people in New England are familiar with. They're the ones that produce Cabot cheese. How do they try to help farmers survive these wild price swings, which are now going against farmers, as you've been saying, Kirk?
Well, the role of co-ops really is in the idea that there's strength in numbers. So, you know, when farmers band together to share services like the trucking and the processing, it makes the whole system more efficient for them. And then they can also have advocacy, you know, in Congress to have things to have laws passed and policies passed, regulations that benefit them. So. You know, they band together. They share services, and hopefully, you know, it'll end up being more profitable.
Let's take another call if we could. This is Bill in West Deering. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting. You're on the Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Glad to be on. I just want to say I grew up in the North Country on a small farm, and it's kind of sad to drive along there and see everything that we used to hay going up to woods. But my point was, what I wanted to ask about was, I read somewhere some time ago that sugar beets had four times the alcohol content than corn, and big agribusiness in the Department of Agriculture, I'm thinking they're the ones who have driven the price up because of that. I mean, they didn't look at any options other than corn for alcohol. Is that right?
We're talking about dairy, Bill. I'm not quite getting your point there. We're talking about dairy farms, not sugar beets. Are you making a point about dairy there?
Well, no. What I was getting, the price of corn feed, I guess, is what I should have got at. But I remember reading that alcohol, it was four times the alcohol in sugar beets as the resin in corn. And I'm wondering if it's agribusiness and the Department of Agriculture have brought us to this high price.
Right. I think I get your point. Concern, again, over the price of corn feed for cows, Kirk, and whether USDA, Department of Agriculture, is partly to blame for that.
Well, I think I'm not sure the USDA is partly to blame for that so much as the the trend these days to, you know, to use ethanol as part of the gasoline mixture for regular automobile gas. And you know, since we've started using ethanol, you know, that means that we're competing with ethanol for corn to be a food product too. So the price, you know, has gone up quite a bit, and that was one of the major reasons why grain costs went so high back in 2007, 2008. That was when a new policy kicked in requiring more ethanol to be put in the gas. So you know, I think there's definitely a connection there between using ethanol as a fuel additive and the high price of food.
Okay. Bill, thanks for the call. And let's go next to Gary in Concord. Hi, Gary. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, Laura. How are you? And Kirk, Gary Hirschberg here. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the show, but so you may have covered this, but I wanted to just insert into the discussion our discovery has been over the last 28 or so years, which is that really organic, recognizing exactly the problems you spoke about federal milk policy back even in the mid-'80s, we began to see that organic was truly the only solution for farmers. We're now supporting 1,600 family farmers. As you know, it's been a growth area. What we're seeing now with a couple of decades of research is you get higher yields, the cows live twice as long, better animal health. This has led to us being able to fund some really important research at UNH that's now, in fact, showing the way that small farmers, even without access to large pastures, you mentioned, Kirk, are able to actually be quite profitable. I think the point I want to, and now there's regional grain sourcing that is we're all starting to look at, particularly, interestingly, the last caller mentioning sugar beets. Most of Arista County, which used to be sugar beet, in Maine, sugar beet and potato production is, of course, laying fallow now as those farms have gone under. And so we're looking at those areas for revitalization of regional grain, which will help also in this. But I think the real point I wanted to make, Laura, is, and for Kirk to comment on, is that ultimately what we've proven is that the consumer really can drive this system. We believe, as you do, that the federal milk system has really failed small and regional farmers, that it's been a sort of a growth toward, you know, tendency towards the very, very large, and that ultimately, at least in our example, and I think in the whole $30 billion.
Gary, I'm so sorry I got to wrap you up. I do appreciate you calling in. Again, Gary Hirschberg from Stonyfield Farm Yogurt. We'll talk about organic milk and much more after a short break.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Tully Mazda in Nashua, presenting the 2012 Mazda 3 with SkyActiv technology, delivering sporty performance and up to 40 miles per gallon. Details on Facebook or at TullyMazda.com. And Vineyard Brands, importers of Mann wines from the coastal vineyards of South Africa. Mann Vintners proudly supports the Susan B. Komen Race for the Cure. MannVintners.co.za. This is NHPR.
There are many ways for your business to support NHPR. Of course, you can get your message to NHPR listeners by underwriting the programs on air, but there are also opportunities to get your message to Granite Staters who use our many new media platforms, including our website, our live stream, and our new iPhone app. Find out how to speak to some of the most independent minds in the state. Visit the business support page at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, major new challenges for New Hampshire charter schools. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Kirk Kardashian. He's author of the brand new book, Milk Money, Cash, Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. Kirk is also senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. If you work in the dairy industry, we want your calls and comments. Why do you think this sector has struggled so much in recent years? What do you think might be the answer to those struggles? Also, just if you're a dairy consumer, if your household consumes lots of milk products, would you be willing to pay more to help local farmers? Or do you think that most consumers like you are just looking for the lowest price possible? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Kirk, just before the break, Gary Hirschberg called in again, founder of Stonyfield Farm Organic Yogurt. Let's talk about organic, because that has seemed to be the bright spot for dairy farms.
Yeah, well, I think there is a bright spot, but it's not all bright. So, for some farmers who invested in switching to organic early enough and were able to get some steam built up before prices went down, then I think they're in good shape. And I think it is a viable business model. But I think it's not the savior of dairy that everybody might think it is.
Why not?
Well, dairy. I mean, organic products at this time only make up a small percentage of total food purchasing. So, while there might be hope that people will start drinking more organic milk, right now it's a pretty small portion. I think it's maybe 4 or 5% of total food consumption is organic. So. The scale is not there yet. That's not to say it won't be there in the future. And the second thing, is that it's quite a big investment for dairy farmers to transition from conventional milk to organic milk. It takes a couple years, and then once they can get their farm certified as organic. Then they'll start reaping the benefits of that as from a higher milk price and a better margin. So it can work, but I think some farmers have been burned. It's like anything. It's not all great. It's not all bad.
Well, some farmers, instead of going organic, have decided to really emphasize the local nature of their milk and the fact that local milk can be brought to the consumer so quickly, super fresh. The end of your book talks about a model like this that other small farmers might look to, a movement out of New York State called Hudson Valley Fresh. What's the guiding principle of this group of dairy producers, especially the one sort of charismatic guy behind this movement?
Well, the guiding principle is quality, I would say. If I'm acting now as the cooperative Hudson Valley Fresh, if we produce a really distinctive, high quality product, and we brand it under our own name, and people have confidence that when they buy our milk, they're getting this high quality product that's only made by a certain number of farmers, and they can trust that process. Then they can ask for a higher price, and they can get it, and they can have a more sustainable farm and a more sustainable business model.
How so? Can you give us a little bit more on that? I mean, more sustainable. What do you mean by that, Kirk?
Well, it's a long story, but it's a really heartening story, and I tell it in the book. But the guy that founded Hudson Valley Fresh, his name is Sam Simon. He was an orthopedic surgeon who grew up on a dairy farm, and he decided to retire from being a doctor and go back into dairy farming. So he brought this sort of meticulous, doctor's mentality to his dairy farm, and he wanted to do it the old-fashioned way, you could say, on a small scale, but really clean, and really local and sustainable. He was getting premium bonuses from his co-op for making great milk, but the bonuses were really not enough to make it worth his while. So he decided to get together with 7 or 8 other local farms that he knew, whom he knew were also making great milk, and they contracted with a processing plant to just process the milk from these 8 farmers. And they bottled it and they marketed it under their own name, Hudson Valley Fresh, and the cost is a little bit more than conventional milk, but also less than organic, so it's right in the middle there, and they're providing this great product. The milk tastes just amazing, people feel good about where it comes from, and they've scaled up to be able to serve to be able to sell 4 million pounds of milk a year to the New York City metro area. And so far, it's working great. So I think there is definitely a lesson to be learned there.
Let's take another call if we could. And this is Diane in Guilford, Vermont. Hi, Diane. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I've been farming here in Guilford, Vermont on the Paul Boyd farm for the last 26 years. His family's run this farm for 100 years. And I would like to say first, I haven't caught the beginning of your show, but it's not possible to feed grass year-round. It's seasonal. And so, therefore, we couldn't strictly rely on that as a commodity for our animals. I think the problem is price regulation. The only way to resolve that is to have a consistent pricing, and Congress is the only one that can really regulate that. We do not have within our co-op the option to hire a specific trucker. There's a contract within AgriMark. So as fuel prices rise for the trucker, that cuts into what we would make in our milk check. And there's really nothing we can do to control that. So I think really ultimately grants would be helpful for a conventional dairy farmer such as solar to cut back on electricity costs and possibly some other tax breaks somewhere that could help us out financially. Other than that, I don't see that there's going to be a resolution to this pricing problem.
You know, Diane, it's good to hear from you because you work right in this business. So a couple questions for you, if I could. You're calling for consistent pricing. So you would like to see somehow the federal government still involved in this pricing mechanism that's come under so much criticism?
I think that's the only resolution, really. Some type of dairy bill that could, when times are, gas is expensive, diesel's expensive, grain is expensive, without their assistance, I see no resolution to that. Our cost of living raise doesn't happen every year. When fuel prices are up, we're not getting a raise, you know, in our milk prices. So without some sort of regulation, I don't see that anybody can survive in a conventional farm.
And Diane, don't take this the wrong way, okay? I'm just going to ask you a devil's advocate question. And that is, you know, you could say, hey, why should you guys get a break? You know, carrot farmers aren't getting a break. I might be suffering because I have a long commute and I'm paying, I'm not saying me personally, but, you know, someone might have a long commute and they're suffering because of high gas prices. So why should dairy farmers get a special break?
I think because we need to recognize that milk is in many products, not just a gallon of milk and on the shelf. It's used for cooking in many aspects. And my question would be in return, would you prefer to have your milk imported from another country, a country that doesn't use the regulations that we use to keep it fresh and to keep our children healthy? Our children's our future, and if we don't feed them, you know, a quality product, where are they going to be in the next 20 years?
Well, that's a concern, especially after the tainted milk scare, right, in China a couple years back.
Yes,
Diane, thank you for joining us. Really good to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What do you think about that question, Kirk? And maybe you can answer it with some of the thoughts that you got from the Vermont farmers that you talked to. I mean, there is an argument. Why should they get special treatment? Diane answered it articulately, but I'd love to hear from you, too.
Well, I can definitely defer to Diane on that. I mean, I think she's right, you know, that that dairy products are something that we as a country value as part of our food system. And, you know, if the economics by themselves without the government don't work, then I think there is a role the government can play to step in and say, look, this is something that we value, and we want to encourage, you know, farmers to produce this high quality product. You know, we want to encourage them to produce milk and yogurt and cheese and butter, and you know, so we're going to help them out a little bit, and it doesn't have to mean, you know, an absolute subsidy or just like a, you know, a handout. It's just guiding the system a little bit better so that it, you know, the economics works out.
Well, and with the Farm Bill stalled in Congress, there's not much hope for immediate assistance. Here's an email from Paulina in Concord. By the way, Diane, thanks again for that call. Paulina says, Brookford Farm in Canterbury seems to be doing well by selling organic, grass-fed raw milk. She says raw milk could be frozen. New Hampshire law allows to sell raw milk. Thus, it seems that New Hampshire milk farmers can expand their market a lot if they sell organic raw grass-fed milk to other states, as there is a huge demand for this now. Thanks, Paulina, for that email. Did you talk about raw milk in the book? And I wonder what you think about Paulina's point.
Yeah, you know, I made a conscious decision to not talk about raw milk in the book because at this point, people who drink raw milk are such a small percentage of the population that, you know, any solution that sort of deals with raw milk, to my mind, is not really helpful right now. But raw milk as a topic I think it's fascinating, and the regulation of raw milk varies from state to state. Some states allow farmers to sell raw milk directly from their farm. Other states allow farmers to sell raw milk in stores, even, and other states ban it completely. So you know, it's quite a contentious topic, and there's lots of people who really advocate strongly for the health benefits of raw milk, and there's others that say that drinking raw milk is, quite frankly, foolish because it might have bacteria in it that could make you very sick or even kill you. So it's a very contentious topic.
What do you hope the message for consumers is from this book, Kirk? You know, it's easy to say, buy the good stuff, local, organic. But if you've got four kids and a limited budget, it's easier said than done. So I wonder, what are you trying to say to those of us who eat, you know, cheese, yogurt, milk, whatever?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I want people to understand that their purchasing power makes a difference. So when you make decisions in the supermarket as to, you know, which products to buy, you're sending a message out there to farmers, to producers. You're saying, you know, I want this certain type of product and not this other kind. So if you want a world, you know, where milk is created, you know, sustainably, where the production of milk doesn't exploit workers and doesn't cause unnecessary suffering to, say, dairy cows, where it doesn't harm the environment, then I think you need to do a little bit of research and figure out how you can best accomplish that through your purchasing. And, you know, the budget concerns, I think, are very valid, and you know, budgets these days are really tight. Groceries are expensive, and supporting a family of four and trying to do the right thing with the food you buy is very difficult. So I think people have to find their own comfort zone and really just make the choices that they're comfortable with and that they can sustain with their budget.
We've talked about different models for dairy farmers that you've seen, that our callers have seen, from grass-fed to organic to promoting a super fresh local product. What do you think the message is for farmers, especially those struggling small dairy farmers in New England that you talked to, Kirk? You know, adopting new models, I wonder if this book is going to give them some ideas about, well, maybe a new way to do things.
Well, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, dairy farmers are a very tenacious breed of people. They work extremely hard. They love what they do. And I think they're always looking for a way to stay in business and to keep dairy farming. So I think, you know, right now the milk prices are low, costs are high, farmers are hurting, and they're always looking for better ways to do it. And I think, you know, if things come up that can present solutions, you know, I think they're open-minded about that a lot of times. But you know, right now, I think it's tough for people to make a transition.
Yeah, it's easier said than done, isn't it? To sort of shift the whole way you do things.
Yeah, for sure, it is, and I think, you know, one of the Hudson Valley Fresh example, you know, they sort of have this perfect galaxy of circumstances that allowed them to do what they do. They found a processing plant that would only process their milk, and that's huge. Other farms have tried to build processing plants to process milk from their farm and from a few others, and they go out and they'll invest, you know, $2.5 million in the plant, and then they don't have the cash flow afterward to pay the debt, and they go out of business. So, you know, it's a very tricky thing, and but I think processing is a big issue. If we could have more processors around the states and sort of keep distribute the processing over a larger number of plants, that would be good. And I think a higher number of smaller farms would be good too. You know, the trend has been in the opposite direction. It's been towards a smaller number of bigger farms. I think in some sense we have to go backwards a little bit.
Here's a last email from Kim, who says, what can we as listeners do to help keep our milk farmers in business? Kim, thanks for the email. Kirk, what do you think?
Well, I think you can buy local products, you know, that that keep your farm your local farmers in business. You can also advocate for your farmers through your representative and your representatives in Congress. Tell them that you understand that farmers are hurting now, you know, and that you want your representatives to go out and advocate for them. You can educate yourself on the issue. You can read my book. It's a complicated topic, and that's why it took a book to explain it all. So I think get out there, learn as much as you can, and voice your opinion.
Okay, Kirk, thanks a lot for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Kirk Kardashian, author of the new book, Milk Money, Cash, Cows, and the Death of the American Dairy Farm. The book is out next month. Kirk is also a senior writer at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about what we're planning, upcoming shows, and get extra links and material. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. I'm Laura Kanoy.